One of the issues in the Old Testament study that animates me as a teacher of the Old Testament, and in case you haven't heard, I teach Old Testament at Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. Just beginning a sabbatical this year, going down to the University of Chicago. But one of the things that animates me in my scripture study is the understanding of God. And I've written a couple of things on God. I'm supposed to give a plug from the bookstore. I'll go up there today maybe and bring it down tomorrow. But I've written a book about 3 years ago entitled The Suffering of God, which is a study of some Old Testament perspectives on God. And this week, what I'd like to do today, I want to introduce the topic by pointing out some of the issues associated with images for God. And then for the balance of the week, one of the edges I'm working on is the relationship between God and nature, kind of fitting for this setting, I think. So tomorrow I want to talk a little bit about Genesis 1, God as creator. I'll make a case for the fact that the world was created in 7 24-hour days. We'll start there. Seriously, what are you going to do with it? And then Wednesday we're going to talk about God and calico cats. And so tomorrow, Genesis 1, and we're going to start with Psalm 139 on Wednesday. And Thursday, one response to suffering, God takes Job to the zoo. And the text for Thursday will be Job 38-41. And Friday's topic is non-human sopranos and tenors. And we'll take a look at Psalm 148. So that's our concern for the balance of the week. Some of the texts in the Old Testament that relate to God and nature, God and the animals, God and the non-human world. It's tough to say something that's non-human, isn't it? It's really denigrating. It's like calling men non-women. But we don't have languages that's very, very helpful to us. So let's have one text before us. We're not going to be into the Bible very much today, but as we will for the balance of the week. But let's have one text before us in Exodus chapter 34. And lift these two verses up as something that we have before us for the week, really. The Lord passed before him, that is to say Moses, and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. That is the most common description of God in the whole Old Testament. That's repeated in one form or another about 10 times in various books. And you hear echoes of that text, particularly in the Psalm, the steadfast love of the Lord endures forever, that kind of echo. And that's going to be kind of center for our most basic understanding of God as we move to explore some other images beyond those central ones. It's not enough to say that you believe in God. What really is crucial is the kind of God in whom you believe. All kinds of people believe in God, but the images, the kind of God, the images that they use to think about God, to reflect on God, to speak about God, are really at the heart of their faith. The images that we use to think and speak about God will not only determine what we think about God, but it will shape our lives. Whether you like it or not, your life will be shaped by the images for God that you hold dear. If your God is primarily a judge. And judging will play a very important role in your life. If your God is primarily the God that's lifted up in those verses from Exodus, then those words are going to play a very important part of your life. Slow to anger, forgiving, steadfast love, faithfulness. The images of God will shape your life, for good or for ill. And so it behooves us to think about our images for God. And that's one of the things we're going to be about this week. My concern, fundamentally, is to expand our images for God. There are, for example, over 50 images for God in the book of Psalms alone. We tend to be satisfied with a couple, Father, King, maybe a few others like that, very common. My concern is to expand the images for God. Thomas Matthews, who was a journalist and a critic, and also a preacher's kid, and hence what he says speaks to me as a third-generation preacher's kid. Listen to what he has to say. Maybe it fits with some of your backgrounds. Try as I may, I cannot altogether shake off my habitual awe of the church, nor completely dissociate it from the far more fearful God to whom the church makes its ritual obeisance. I still think of God as I was trained as a child to envision him, as a watchful, vengeful, enormous, omniscient policeman. Instantly aware of the slightest tinge of irreverence in my innermost thoughts, always ready to pounce on me if I cursed, if I mentioned him in anger, fun, or mere habit, though with ominous patience he might hold his hand for a time. But here comes this question. How can that kind of fear of that kind of God be the beginning of wisdom? That's our question. Think back. When was the last time you ever saw somebody attempt a picture of God? Been to Rome? Been to the Sistine Chapel? One of the few efforts on the part of classical painters to paint, to picture God. And you've all seen the picture of it, I'm sure, that picture of God with that finger outstretched to the not yet created Adam. And you have Michelangelo's efforts there to portray God as kind of a stern, forbidding, creative God. Not many have attempted to picture God. But I can imagine that if you were to reflect for a moment, certain images might come to mind for you. Maybe it would be the father and the prodigal son story. Maybe that would come to mind quickly for many of you. Maybe it would be a military image, though. You know, General Patton, kind of a hierarchical, authoritarian type of God. Maybe in this time when business rules the world in so many ways, maybe it'd be the kind of chairman of a board, a person in control of a major corporation, and you would begin to spin out your understanding of God in terms of one who was in charge of IBM or something. Maybe you'd go just the opposite and move away from hierarchical authoritarian images, and you'd go to more namby-pamby images. You know, when I was growing up, one of the songs that they drilled into me in my pietistic home was, you know, my God and I walk through the fields together, we walk and talk as good friends used to do. Some of you maybe remember that song. Huh? You know, God and me, arm in arm, down the paths, you know, kind of buddy-buddy. There's a tendency, I think, among us in many ways to move in that direction with our images of God. A God who is never critical, a God who is never judgmental, a God who, you know, unlike that end, we like that text which we just read and went along until we got to, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity. Get a little uncomfortable. I think that's the day in which we live more than in a God who is critical and more judgmental. A professor who's never critical, that's my image for God. That's my problem with God. The images of God. How can we speak meaningfully, think meaningfully of God in this kind of world in which we live? If you think about many of the ways in which the church has imaged God, I think, you know, of that hymn, I know it's a wonderful tune, but I can't stand the words. This God who is immortal, invisible, God only wise, in light inaccessible, hid from our eyes. All those words about God, for whom the language of interpersonal or personal relationship seems quite foreign. I mean, how can you relate to a God like that? And you get words like this that the church throws around: supernatural, self-sufficient, omnipotent, omniscient, immutable, incorporeal, invisible, impassible, unchangeable, immovable, infinite, transcendent. I mean, all these words, how can you connect with any of those words? So much of our language about God seems to be disjunctive from our everyday experience. What the church says about God just doesn't seem to fit commonly. I mean, so we have masculine language for God. It just pervades the life of the church. But how does that connect with feminine experience? A real increasing problem among us. What are we going to do with that issue? Or we've got language about God which is socially very comfortable. I mean, you can go to church on Sunday morning and none of the language about God really jars you at all. I mean, you just kind of flow with it, right? I mean, you're not surprised or very much or very often about the language used of God on a typical Sunday morning. Well, that seems to exclude those that are striving for liberation from oppression, for one thing. Or our language about God is quite commonly authoritarian, it's hierarchical. And that's difficult to relate to a society where democracy is very important, huh? Where in situations where what people have to say counts, what people do counts. And if you've got a God who does everything, how are you going to connect that image for God with your own experience? Or, and you get language about God that's, unemotional language, impassible language, immovable language, stoic language. God wouldn't be moved by anything, right? Well, how does that kind of language fit with the experience of incomprehensible evil and suffering in the world? I mean, really, you're going to have a God who sits up in heaven and who just kind of, you know, views all the suffering and evil and remains impassive in the face of all that? I mean, that's an image of God which the church has given to us time and time again. How are you going to connect those? Well, the tendency is, well, that church language about God just going to roll right off you. It's not going to, if it doesn't connect with your life in some important way, it's not going to get in there where it counts and where it can work in your life. Or omnipotence language for God. You know, this God who can do everything, this all-powerful God. And that simply excludes many people. Because for many of us, if God is all-powerful, and if God is love, and we're suffering at the hands of some evil, why isn't God taking care of this for me? God must be either all-powerful and arbitrary, capricious, or God is loving and not all-powerful. Maybe, huh? Well, the language we use about God seems increasingly to not fit with everyday experience. And my concern is to explore the Bible explore the biblical materials, particularly the Old Testament, to try to find images for God that connect with life experience more than some of the traditional language of the church has. All those words that I listed off that we use for God, omnipotence and so forth, that biblical language, most of that language which the church has used for God doesn't come from the Bible, it comes from somewhere else. Now, let me back up for just a moment and talk a little bit about why I'm concerned about some of this. One of the things I'm concerned about is the fact that the Old Testament's got a lot of bad press. The God of the Old Testament gets a lot of bad press. And as a teacher of the Old Testament, I get concerned. I mean, God is perceived to be a distant God. God is an authoritarian God. God's a God of wrath and law and judgment. God of floods and fire and brimstone and holy wars and all those kinds of things. And God strikes out in seemingly capricious ways. And that's an image of God. Those images for God that you find in the Old Testament, it is said, they need to be corrected by the New Testament. So Jesus sort of came to save us from that kind of God. Common image. Now the problem with that, of course, is that the New Testament notions with regard to God are just as problematic as anything you find in the Old Testament. We just don't think about it often enough. But, you do have the God of the New Testament who sends people to hell where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth for an eternity. That's a level of violence that's written. We don't find a parallel to that level of violence in the Old Testament in terms of God's involvement. In any case, one of my basic concerns is to show that there is considerable continuity between the God of the Old Testament and the God that we see revealed in Jesus. That there's much, much greater continuity there than the press in the church and outside the church would commonly give to us. we Lutherans, and others who are not Lutheran too in these traditions, like to say that Jesus is the clue to God. That is to say, in Jesus we see revealed who God is and what God is about in the life of the world. And I think that we're often incoherent when we say things like that. Because I think that we as a church commonly hold together this picture of Jesus and an amazingly imperious notion of God. And they don't connect very well. And my concern is to get them back together again. And it's a matter of, think of lifting up images for God that are throughout the Old Testament and which have been commonly ignored in the life of the church. Another thing that animates me here is a concern for evangelism, the mission of the church. I'm convinced, and maybe some of you have testimonies here that will add to this, I'm convinced that one of the leading stumbling blocks to the mission of the church is this image of God, which is not very helpful in dealing with, particularly with some of the hard issues of life. You press people who are outside the congregations, press people who are on the periphery of the congregations, and just kind of dabble in church. Press them. And it's surprising how often it is that some image of God is what keeps them away, or that keeps them from really becoming involved. What's the religious bestseller in the 1980s? Some New Age stuff is certainly coming in now. It's beginning to emerge in ways that hasn't been the case in the early 80s, I think. But I think if you were to go to the charts, you'd probably find Rabbi Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, probably the bestseller. Bought by Christians, I think, more often than not. Why is it that people are buying a book and other books like that? I think it says something about how close to the surface God questions are for many people. We may not like what Krishna has to say commonly about, he's got a lot of good things to say, but we may not like everything he has to say. But I think what we need to ask is, why is it that people buy the book? Why is it that they're searching for answers you know, in a book that's titled like that. Why are they drawn to it? Why are people drawn to it? There's a couple years ago, the LCA had, in the Lutheran ran an article on what's on your mind, and they did a survey of 24 congregations in the LCA from it really covered the spectrum, and they came up with the seven most asked questions by members of these congregations. Listen to these questions. Why me, God? Why evil? How do I cope? Can I trust God? What is God's will for my life? You know, and then there's one on the Bible and one on worship. But four of the seven questions had to do with God. None of the seven questions had to do with Jesus. We got Jesus kind of all taken care of. The questions are, where is God? What is God? I'm also concerned as a person who has been involved for 20 years in teaching pastors and to be and lay professionals to be. I'm concerned about the impact of God images on the leadership of the church. I think it can be demonstrated that there are close correlations between the images of God which pastors and other leaders in the church have and their leadership style. I think one could perhaps expand that beyond church leadership to talk about every Christian and the way in which they comport themselves in their daily life and leadership ways. But if Deuteronomy 10, we are God's people and we're to walk in all of God's ways. And if we're to walk in all of God's ways and we have an imperious notion of God, we've got an authoritarian notion of God, then imperialistic notions of leadership are going to manifest themselves in one way or another in our ministries. The images of God with which we live will shape our lives for good or for ill. I'm also concerned about children and the images of God for children. Let me recommend a book for you. That should be required, should be in every congregation's library. It's a book published in 1986 entitled The Children's God by David Heller. Heller is a psychologist who is also a rather sophisticated theologian, I think, by the way in which he talks about some of these things. And he surveyed 40 children between the ages of 4 and 12 about what kind of God they believed in. And it's really an amazing book. In fact, Hugh Downs of ABC's 2020 picked up the book and did some interviewing of children on their own to see whether or not their interviews of children corresponded with some of Heller's results. And I wrote to ABC News and got their transcript of that program. I just happened to pick it up on television, and I was just astounded by what some of these kids had to say. I think we underestimate our children. And that the church has failed them by not addressing some of these God issues more directly early on. Here's the moderator from ABC's 2020. The psychologists say that the open debates about God happen by the time a child is 10 or 11 years old, because by this age the kids know that we parents don't have all the answers. Earlier than that, right? Yeah. Also, instead of just accepting a good, all-knowing God, these kids have some tough questions. And one of the ways in which Heller and ABC News, some of the methods that they use to try to get children to speak about their images of God, they use the interview pattern as if God were interviewing them, or they were writing letters to God and things of that kind, so that they were able to draw it out pretty well. Here's a young girl. Are you a God? Are you a real person? Is it true that you really made the earth, the water, and the people? Why should I believe in you? Here's Kevin. Why do we have to die and work and go to school? I think an ascending level. Yeah. Why couldn't we be born equal and have no bad people? Here's a young girl. God, why do you let tragedies happen if you're so powerful? Why do you let accidents happen? And why do you let people get diseases? I probably won't understand, but please write back. The moderator enters in again. Do you have any doubt that God exists? Here's Lisa. Now, these are 10, 11, 12-year-olds. Okay, Lisa. No, I think, sometimes. Like once in a while when something bad really happens. Other kids had explanations as to how bad things could happen under a good God. Here's Kevin again. And I saw this on television. I just couldn't believe it was coming out of this child's mouth. God can create things, but he can't control them so well. Like, he can create men and women and, put them on earth, but he can't control so much what they do. Now, here's a young girl. I think that when God put people on the earth, that he had to leave some things up to chance. Now, tell me, are our Sunday school materials written to address themselves to questions like that? Heller, he's got a chapter on gender in his book, and it's really a fascinating chapter where he distinguishes between the images of God that the girls have and the images of God that the boys have. And why don't we talk about this in the church? Listen to some of his comments here, sort of summaries of these interviews. In general, the God representations of the girls are not nearly so grounded in concrete facts and events as are those of the boys. The girls collectively present a God that's closer to sound and color, closer to nature and natural phenomena, and farther from the boys' images of God, which are close to technical and scientific constructions. The girls present a God of at least relative emotional intimacy, in contrast to the more distant God that the boys describe. And then he gives some quotes from, he addresses the gender issue with regard to God, and listen to these kids. Here is a 7-year-old. Usually, God is a man. But some people think he could be a woman, with long hair and all. I don't see why he always has to be a man. Here's a 12-year-old. I believe that God may have a little of both sexes, but I'm afraid to say this out loud. I guess because people might think I'm stupid or something. And Heller really goes after the church at that point. He says that the church has again and again turned off the questions. They refuse to entertain the tough questions. And after a while, the kids just quit asking them. They either turn off the questions by, giving pat answers to things, or by suggesting that we know everything there is to know, and what you're talking about, isn't in the sphere of what we know. So it's, I think that the whole, the issue of the images for God is a crucial one in terms of the children of the church and how we pass the faith on from one generation to the next. Yes, please.
It seems to me that the whole issue of the inclusive language, and people say, well, what's the big deal? But it seems to me that the subtleties that we do teach our kids through, the real subtleness that comes with use of the inclusive language begins to let kids know that, God is not just who, there is that both sidedness.
Yeah. I think that's an important comment. I think that this week, David Pellauer, I see, is I've not talked to him, but he's giving presentations on God as mother and God as lover, God as friend, And that, that sounds to me like that's the kind of material that will help lift up some of these inclusive issues.
Well, it seems like it's those policies that really speak to us, too. If you want to say that it doesn't really, you know, it's not a big deal, but...
As if language didn't really have an effect upon
but
the
it
way
does.
It sure does, yeah.
So we have one family in our congregation that stopped coming because they thought we were rewriting the Bible by using inclusive language.
Okay, then, so you do get some reactions going the other way, too. Not a crucial issue or one that we ought to back off from just because there might be some difficulties associated with it. There's an article in the Virginia Seminary Bulletin that I picked up the other day that has some very interesting comments about the effect of our images for God not only on our personal lives but also on our national life, our community life. Let me just read a few sentences for you. Everywhere we stubbornly cling to the notion that the higher we go on any scale of achievement, the more acceptable we are as human beings. The capital impediment of the human soul is thus horrendous unbelief, the imprisoning unbelief of believing that human achievement is the measure of human worth. Institutionally, as in the case of admirals and bishops, financially, socially, morally, especially morally in the case of religious people. In other words, we're makers of our own worth. And this is an impossible strain on the human spirit. Salvation by importance is bondage to cosmic nonsense. Let me read this. Salvation by importance is bondage to cosmic nonsense. Either human self-worth is a gift or it doesn't exist. Who told us that we can't be ordinary? Who told us we couldn't fail as Peter did? Did you ever think that a pervasive disallowance of not making it may lie at the root of our pervasive stress and depression in this proud and belligerent society? What lies at the root of all of this? It's a perverse and popular theology. It's a cosmic potentate in the guise of God. The real issue is our images of God. It's an image of God Almighty, as finished, as polished, as utterly unneedy, as complete, all wrapped up in sovereign majesty and morally offended by a sorry human race, merciful with us as a kind of last resort before giving up on us. If the perfection of God is a glistening, self-fulfilled, serenely composed cosmic wizardry, does not that become the subtle but all-powerful norm for human aspiring? And for America struggling for dominant power, you see how a theology translates into foreign policy? Of course God is king, but this king's identity is an offense to popular images of sovereignty. This king's feet are dusty with arms around hardly finished children and hardly proper streetwalkers and hardly polished prodigals. And as for God's blazing impatience, this is reserved almost exclusively for stuffed shirts who pretend perfection. Let me...
Was that from the Heller scale?
No, that's from the Virginia Seminary Bulletin.
Oh.
From this past spring. Permit me a childhood recollection as a way of concluding here, and we can open up this up a little bit. When I was a child, I loved the color. And one of my memories of my childhood is a green and orange box with 64 crayons. They were called Crayolas, you remember. And they were all different colors, and there were some wonderful colors, like burnt umber and things of that kind in this box. And that was one of my great childhood dreams, was to get one of these boxes of 64 colored crayons. But my parents thought, apparently, that this large pack was somewhat mature for me, and so I had to do with, you know, the 16 crayon box and the 24 crayon box. And had to do that for a long time. But my goal was to so improve my skill at coloring pictures that my parents would buy me the largest box of crayons available, the 64 crayon box. Somehow I believed in my childhood mind that my experience of the world was at least a 64 crayon experience. Now, I didn't think that way, but that must have been what I thought. That the world was so full of sound and color that how could one capture all of those colors, those tints, those hues, except with the largest quiver of crayons available? I never did get the 64 crayon box. Nowadays, I understand they have 128. Yeah. Is that right, or something like that? Okay. Well, for most of us, even 64 crayons can't capture the wonders of our daily experience of the world and all the colors around us, and particularly in a place like this. We're surrounded with rainbows. And why is it, then, that most of us seem satisfied with an 8-crayon God? We seem content with only a few strokes of color in our talk about God. In fact, the language that we use sometimes to speak about God is monochromatic. It's almost single-colored. So familiar have these few colors that we use become that we've got sort of a ready-made God canvas, and it looks the same regardless of the light that may be available, regardless of the angle of vision that we may have. But is it any wonder, with that kind of picture of God, that people are not all that attracted to the God whom we confess? They cannot see how it's possible to fit together a 64 crayon experience of life with an 8 crayon God. So, the concern is images and the expansion of images. Now, one of the problems that we're going to run into, I suppose that you've all seen children attempt to draw pictures of God, and you'll commonly see an old man with a white beard. And when we're thinking about these variety of images, remember that we can fall off the horse on one side or the other. We can fall off the horse on one side by literalizing the image. And so we say, God is a father. Well, then we must take, you know, all that we know about fathers and say, literally, that is what God is like. Or, you know, we get an image of Ancient of Days or something, and so we get old as a part of our image for God, and we literalize that. But we commonly also fall off the horse on the other side. And we say, well, all these images that we have for God so outdistance the God that we have that in no way are they descriptive of God. There's no way in which that language connects with God at all. And that's even more, I think, more a problem that we face these days than the other one. Problem is to see that with regard to each image that we use for God, from father to king to gracious one to lover to friend, whatever, is to see that in all of these images there are both continuities and discontinuities. There are things that do in fact correspond with God as God really is. And there are other things which do not correspond. And so we need to examine these images to see what in fact is continuous with God and discontinuous with God. But we can't even get involved in that conversation unless we've got a range of images with which we're working. One of the idolatry in the Old Testament, the common matter against which prophets and others rail, And we oftentimes think that idolatry is just a matter of wood and stone images. One of the problems of idolatry is that God is sold short, and that there are insufficient, an idol is too monochromatic. That's the problem. And so in a psalm like 115, you've got these strong points where idols are contrasted with God. Psalm 115, beginning with verse 3. 4. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of people's hands. They have mouths but do not speak. They have eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear. They have noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel. They have feet but do not walk. They do not make a sound in their throat. Problem with idols is you see that they're too limited in the way in which they talk about God or the way in which they attempt to image God. So one of the concerns about images is the concern about idolatry, and that we in fact color God with the kind of range of colors that in fact is available to us in the scriptures that we have. Well, let's get started with a few questions at least today, and the balance of the week, and if some are going to be here next week, we're going to continue on some of these topics relative to images for God.
I think that in the images of God, you have to distinguish between the emotional and the intellectual. And I see that sometimes in the church, this whole picture is blurred. They make the emotional intellectual, you say you have to understand it, but you can only feel it. Mm-hmm. And what you feel, etc. Right? So it's almost like Jesus, who was playing with children and teaching adults, and what we do in Bible class is the opposite.
No, thank you. I think that the intellect emotional issue is a very important one in the images in images for God. I think by and large the church has conveyed a God of intellect, a God of mind, a God of word, a God of big boys don't cry, of course, right? And so God is normally a God without emotion, except maybe anger. You get anger in there, but you don't get the other emotions too prominently in one's imaging of God. That needs to change because there are all kinds of biblical resources there.
The problem I see often is not that we do need a God of 128 or 64 colors, but people whose life's experiences are 128 think they need a God of 8 colors. Life is so full of ambiguity and chaos that they need to tunnel in and see a God, very narrow, to create some sort of order in their lives. And if you tell us that there's now 128, not even God is chaotic. How do you deal with that need?
I think you're certainly correct that I think one of the reasons why the church has gotten along with an 8 crayon God is because it is a more comfortable image. It is, one can control God. One can sort of bring God within range easier if one's colors like, or if one's images are somewhat more limited. I don't know how to. Maybe it's a matter of testimony to say if in fact your experience of God is painted in multiple, many and varied colors. By sharing those colors, other people can be attracted to your God, and they can realize that, hey, it's not just chaos, but it's richness and complexity and those good words.
But then the other problem is you almost push to the point of so inclusive that nothing is excluded, and no matter what you believe, as long as you're sincere in it, it's okay. Are there colors that aren't proper images of God?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, that would be, is a computer, for example, to bring a modern image? Is a computer a proper image for God? Or is that not very helpful? Maybe criminal, is criminal a proper image for God? I mean, one can move down the list, and I think that...
How about wrathful?
Sure.
I mean, that's one that it's in the Bible, but
yeah.
Most of us are uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I think that one does need to raise that image, and I think that there are also some continuities with Jesus' own ministry at that point. But there are certain images, such as in the Exodus 34 passage that we read, that I think are kind of a canon within the canon with regard to images. The Lord your God is gracious, merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. Okay, those are central. And any other images that one wants to call upon to help fill out that picture of God will need to be normed by those central images.
That's the primary part.
Yeah, good. Primary colors are a norm for any strange mix, color mix that you might come up with out there in the shed.
Gary?
Yes?
Robertson Davies had one of his characters say that it was rumored that Jesus had a very bad temper. And then, you know, there's a comment back, and then the person that says this says, he took after his father. One of the problems that I think a lot about is simply that we don't no longer have a very good idea of what metaphor is. And I'm not sure why that is. It seems to me that we've lost of an understanding of what a metaphor is and how much it can bear.
Yeah.
That we either load too much on it and then it breaks or falls apart, or else that is, I think we're becoming, you know, as a society, very, very literal, and I don't know why. It's almost like the fundamentalists have forced us into, they're kind of like a cargo cult that have gone back to some former tribe and entrenched themselves, and this is the way it's got to be because I say it. And I don't know if you have does that have something to do with our technical advances or television or any. I mean, I don't understand it, but I sense that people do not understand metaphor the way they used to.
I'm not certain that they used to. All that well, but
I'm not sure that clergy understood it. At least as a former teacher of English, I could teach that more readily than I can now.
I think though
you have to say it. Maybe we don't hear metaphor.
Why
with your computer example, there are bugs in the computer. The computer is down.
Well, it's either on off. I mean, sort of a black white, but it's a sort of an on off world.
With every metaphor, one has to play with both continuities and discontinuities. And with some metaphors, you've got a heavier, you've got a wider range of continuities than with others. And some are consequently more appropriate, more helpful, more insightful than other metaphors are. But I think the problem commonly, I think maybe among more conservative Christians, maybe the problem is literalizing the metaphor. I think with more liberal Christians, I think they fall off the horse on the other side.
Yeah.
And they don't see continuities between any of the metaphors and God as God really is. And so there's idolatry on both sides of that issue.
Yeah.
And so it's a matter of taking the audience of which one is a part or to which one is speaking, or, you know, and kind of assessing the audience to see where one needs to push or pull that issue. Which one went out to address.
We're also used to what we call definitions, which are supposed to be exhaustive and complete. And furthermore, there is some other definition which must be wrong. So the right definition, the wrong definition. But metaphors don't work that way. They're not exhaustive. And several which seem to be incongruous with each other can still be right.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You got metaphors that are flat out contradictory to one another. What are you going to do with the fact that God is both father and husband? I mean, you start playing with that a little bit, and you got incest.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphors are, they are often in tension with one another. And it's you can't press them overly much on the one hand. On the other hand, there's great depth there. Metaphors have a way of sinking deep into yourselves in a way that more prosaic language does not. And that's why images of God are crucial, will shape your life in more subtle ways than straightforward language will. Important point. Yes, ma'am?
Relating to what how the discussion is going so far, I keep thinking about the politics of the United States in the last 8 years. I have a sense of the politics have become more and more connected with our images of God, in that particularly President Reagan seems to have a very literal sense of God, which you had mentioned, if you can describe God, you can kind of control God. If you have a particular description of God, you can control that. And that seems to relate to me with the Star Wars. If you can describe it, then it's okay. Or if you can name it, then you control it, and it's going to work out.
Uh-huh.
And instead of realizing that maybe it's beyond your scope, maybe God is beyond what you can control with eight colors. And I get the feeling that President Reagan okays what he does because he can describe it. He can control it.
Well, I'm not going to get into the politics of that comment, but I think one could talk about individuals in those terms, and it would be a matter of analysis of their speeches and so forth to see whether that would fit. But the, I think that it's very true. I worry more sometimes. Maybe it's because of theologians with whom I consort and hobnob all the time. I worry that we will press the other button, that we cannot finally say anything about them. That's where I think the problem comes, in some circles. And I think that we need to lift up these metaphors as, in fact, revelation for us, you know, insight into who God is and what God is about in the world. So, it depends upon the audience with which one is working, whether one has a very limited and hence very, you know, controlling sense, or on the other hand, where one can't see anything at all. Yes, ma'am.
This discussion bothers me slightly in that it is, I guess I have a hard time. I like intellectualizing about God, but I guess maybe primarily as a female, I tend to say, if we are the created of the Creator, why is it that we strive so much to have to understand Him? There's no possible way we could understand everything about God. And why is it so hard to accept that variance, that we are under Him, we're underneath Him, we can't ever become equal enough to understand everything there is about Him, and to just try to, I don't know, accept all our emotions and all our differences as human beings as handed down as parts and elements of God, but that we can't become on the same equal level.
Well, let me grant your point. First of all, we can't be on the same equal level. Jesus said, I will send the Spirit to lead you into all the truth. And I think that we are asked thereby to study the Scriptures, to work with one another, to try to understand this faith which we have and this God which we have more deeply than we have up to this point. I think that there is all kinds of knowledge of God available to us that we haven't even begun to fathom. So that's what we're trying to work at here. But God outdistances all of our attempts to understand, but there's a lot there that's available to us, I think, where the exploration will be fruitful. That's the bell. Thank you very much.
Thank you.